Welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Ewan Graham. I'm the Director of International Security at the Institute. Michael Fully Love is currently in the United States, so unable to attend. I'm standing in his place. But as you can tell from the accent, it's not entirely coincidence that I've been chosen to host and open our distinguished speaker, Director of Chatham House in the UK, Dr. Robin Niblett, who is here to speak to us today with the clock fast ticking down to June the 23rd and the referendum on whether the UK will stay or leave in Europe. And the theme of his presentation to us today is Britain's uncertain future, for which Robin is extremely well qualified, having in numerous incarnations, including in CSIS in Washington, covered the European program from there, transatlantic issues, and is, of course, an expert in his own right on British foreign policy. And I'll just mention that he has recently published a paper available already online at Chatham House entitled Britain, the EU, and the Sovereignty Myth. Robin will speak to us for about 25 minutes, half an hour, and then you'll have a chance to ask him some questions. Robin, thank you very much for coming all the way from UK to talk to us. Over to you.
Well, thanks, Ewan. Thank you for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation. Delighted to be here back at Lowy. I had a chance of visiting the Institute about 5-6 years ago in your other premises before substations and things like that. So, I think as an opportunity to be able to come and share ideas directly over here is something we really appreciate the opportunity to do. Some of my colleagues get to travel out to Australia from time to time. Hopefully we can sustain it as well into maybe doing some work together in the future. So just delighted to be here and to have a chance to talk about this very important topic with you today. June 23rd, as you said, the clock is ticking. It's almost good to be away for a week. I just couldn't take any more. I just thought Australia is about the right place to be. And then I'll re-immerse myself from Monday onwards for the last 4 weeks before the referendum itself. It's becoming painful at the moment in terms of the intensity of it. And as I think the title of the paper that I put out earlier, about a week and a half ago, indicates, you can see where I'm coming at this from. Chatham House does not take institutional positions, but I've put myself on the record, having been analyst of the EU for most of my career, but also British foreign policy. You'll know where I'm coming from, and you'll definitely get a clue of that from my remarks today. So let me go and talk a bit about looking ahead to the EU referendum, Britain's uncertain European future. And let me get one thing out of the way at the beginning. Maybe in the Q&A we can go into how we got here. What are we doing here? Is an interesting first question to ask. But I think before kind of getting into the structure of the presentation, I just want to say this is really almost a tactical accident in the sense that, if I were to put it in a nutshell, I personally think that David Cameron and George Osborne lost their nerve in 2011 and thought, you know, we're not going to have the economic tailwinds we thought we'd have when we try to get a majority for the Conservatives in 2015 and go back and fight the next general election. At the same time, these are two people who had come into government, coalition government, to their disappointment, nonetheless, to coalition government in 2010, having said they didn't want to talk about Europe. EU was not going to be their focus. They were going to take Britain back to the future almost and focus on emerging markets and China and Australia and India and just stop obsessing about Europe and, in fact, even the transatlantic relationship. All they asked of the other EU leaders who they met prior to the 2010 general election, and I know because some of them told me this, was please don't do any more European integration. If you don't do any more European integration, we won't have to, you know, get stuck in that conservative obsession about Europe. We really don't want to talk about Europe. We want to focus about the rest of the world. But the Eurozone crisis blew up end of 2010, 2011, into 2012. The British economy was stalled. It wasn't growing. UKIP, the UK Independence Party, started to rise, and lo and behold, let's promise to do a referendum if we get re-elected, came out as a great idea. And if you look at the Bloomberg speech that David Cameron gave announcing this kind of intention, it's a strange speech because in it, when you review his bit about why being in the EU has been beneficial for the UK, even in that speech you start to think, well, then why are we holding a referendum? Or why are you promising a referendum? But the fact of the matter is, this referendum, which we are now fully immersed in and is one of the most seminal political decisions for the UK in a long time, it does reveal and expose and provide insights into the British debate about Europe and, in the long term, into the kind of partner that Britain will be to Europe and to the EU, whether it's in or out, yeah, either way. And I think there are five kind of issues at play that I want to run through. And after just describing these five kind of drivers of the British debate, I'll give a bit of a picture of what it might look like if Britain's in or out after the referendum before I conclude. And I suppose my bottom line is that each of these five issues that is driving the referendum process has an element of truth in it, in the implicit critique that they provide about the European Union. But for all of that implicit level of truth, they will not be resolved by leaving the EU. You will not be able to fix the problem that is driving the referendum debate by leaving the EU, in my opinion. And even if the UK does leave the EU, it will not be able to detach itself from the EU, which will be the supreme irony if Britain does vote to leave. So, first of all, the thing that's one of the drivers, the fact is Britain has always been in but out at the same time of the European Union. And I don't need to go through the whole thing with you. Island nation, empire, winner of the Second World War, on the victorious side, should we say. And as a result, you've got Winston Churchill saying that he's a big believer in the United States of Europe, very good for those European nations, not for us, of course. And that kind of attitude led to the UK rejecting becoming part of the EU in 1957, or the European Economic Community, as it was then called, and really being driven into it as the British economy started to perform badly in relative terms compared to the rest of continental Europe in the 60s, turned down twice by the French, and eventually joining in 1973 and then having that confirmed in the referendum of 1975. But it was driven to join by economic circumstances. As a result, there is no emotional connection with being a member of the European Union in the UK. Well, there are very few that feel it. I had to give a talk once in Dublin, and the former Irish ambassador there, who was chairing the meeting, said, "Robin, what we don't understand in Ireland is why you can't get emotional about the EU. I mean, we can." And I said, No. The UK can get emotional about the EU when it thinks about what it doesn't like. But if it has to be in, then it has to be very pragmatic. And you see this in the press. The press, the large elements of the press, have been able to feed off a consistent anti-EU emotion and know that it resonates through the majority of the British public. Apart from Tony Blair and, of recent prime ministers, and you have to go back to Edward Heath to find a prime minister who would ever talk about the value of being in the EU. They've seen little value politically in putting forward the benefits that the UK has gained. And I think the referendum, therefore, is a reminder to the rest of the EU, and it's come as a shock to other EU leaders, that for the UK, EU membership is a choice, not a necessity. This then becomes a big problem for David Cameron, who's given himself, as far as I can tell, about 8 weeks to try to convince a majority of the British voters that being in the EU is a necessity, not just a choice. If you look at the language that's being used right now, the risk of instability in Europe, the implications for the long-term health of the British economy, the arguments being deployed by David Cameron have rightly raised the question of him, if it's so essential, why are we having the referendum? Question posed to him at the speech he gave back on the 9th of May in the British Museum by Laura Kunzberg, the BBC political correspondent. Now, it also means, if you do believe what David Cameron is now saying about the importance of it, that, as I said, if Britons vote to leave, they might choose to try and find a way to remain despite that, and you hear echoes of this in some of Boris Johnson's utterances, you know, we'll leave, but we'll kind of find a way back in. But it also means if Britain votes to remain, it might vote again in the future to leave. This will not be resolved, I think, just through this one referendum. Second point, important driver here, the economy. Could Britain do better outside? This is one of the big themes that you get in this debate from those who are arguing to leave. Daniel Hannan, the member of the European Parliament, who they always have the most colourful language, the folks who are arguing leave, he's talked for at least 2 years now about Britain being shackled to the corpse of Europe. Yeah? EU, ageing continent, slow growth, high unemployment. You know, the picture is of an EU that is the antithesis of the vibrant emerging markets, you know, which Australia has tapped into and other countries that define the whole notion of rising powers. And, you know, what you end up then with is this sense that the EU is hidebound with regulation, that it's a sort of continental bureaucracy that, again, is antithetical to what Margaret Thatcher forced Britain through in the 1980s and took the tough calls to deregulate the British economy, the unions, make the labour markets more flexible, and that if it wasn't for those EU regulations, Britain could do even better than it's doing today. That we, in the end, don't need the EU to drive structural reform inside the UK, as many continental European governments do. They need the deus ex machina of Eurozone membership and being told by Brussels to open up their labour markets. We've done that stuff already. All we're being done is held back. And then this other lovely phrase you always hear from those arguing leave, that Britain is a proud trading nation. The word proud always appears before trading nation. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it's meant to, you know, hark you back to rule Britannia and so on. And that sort of implicitly, the persistent trade deficit that the UK's had now in combined goods and services, it's in goods because we have a surplus in services, but in the trade deficit we've been carrying now for 7-8 years, is really the EU's fault somehow. That if we weren't in the EU, we'd be less regulated, not held back by being tied to this corpse of a decaying Europe, and we could pursue our flexible future. Well, you know, I think the data doesn't exactly stack up. First of all, the UK economy is actually doing very well. And one of the big lines of the Brexiteers always is, you know, Britain's the fifth largest economy in the world. Exactly. Inside the EU, it has become the fifth largest economy in the world. It's got low unemployment. It's got high rates of growth. It has been consistently the highest attractor of foreign direct investment in the EU, again, for the last 9 to 10 years, partly because people can come in and be tapped into the UK's more flexible economy, but be connected to the EU single market at the same time. But something that people don't talk about as much, Britain is ranked as having the second lowest level of business regulation in the OECD, below the US, below Australia, New Zealand, below any other EU country except for the Netherlands, despite being in the EU. So, you know, what is the regulation that is holding Britain back in that case? Most of the things holding Britain's economy back, and you tend to find this in low productivity that the British economy has in particular, are self-inflicted. They're not EU-inflicted. Low standards of primary and secondary education, insufficient long-term funding for finance from businesses compared to Germany in particular, insufficient investment in infrastructure, whether it be energy, transport, planning laws which make housing and so on more expensive than they need to be. You go through the list. As you go through the list, I think you won't find the EU actually being the thing that is holding the UK back. And once you start talking about those great emerging markets and that trade deficit, of course, Germany and the Netherlands seem to run very good trading surpluses per capita and in total terms as EU members. And even if you take in this issue that Britain really is a services exporter more than a goods exporter, and that if it were outside the EU, it'd be able to export those services because the EU market just favours goods exporters, it ignores the fact that those emerging markets that you're meant to sell to are actually going through a very difficult transitional period right now from developing to emerging markets. And the very sectors they're going to be most protective of are likely to be the service sectors. And the final point I'd make is probably the biggest on this economy side. I think probably the biggest trade deal available to the UK in the coming years will be having a more open EU services market. The EU services market is still only about 30% open. The UK would benefit massively from opening up that market. Of course, if it leaves the EU, it won't be designing the rules under which those services will be opened. It'll become a rule taker rather than rule maker, as people argue. And ultimately, we can go through the models if you want later on. At some level, it will be disadvantaged by being outside its main export market. 45% of exports currently go to the EU. And we'll probably end up having, as I said again, to engage with those EU governments and commission on the terms of its access constantly, even if it were outside. But this brings me to the third point that is driving this referendum, and that's immigration. Because in the end, immigration, the high levels of immigration that are coming into the UK from the EU have been driven by its economic success as an EU member. I'm sure many of you know here, but just to recap it quickly, if you are a member of the EU, you cannot prevent the movement of EU citizens coming to seek and take up work in the UK. It's one of the four freedoms: free movement of goods, capital, services, not fully done yet, and labour. So that is a limitation that Britain trades off, you might say, in order to be able to export its goods and services to Hungary, Poland, Spain, Portugal, is that they can export their price competitive element, which might be labour, in return. But being open to the free movement of labour is not the same as having open borders. The UK is not a member of the Schengen Agreement, the agreement that some 24 members of the EU, not the exact number, the majority, big majority of EU members have done, whereby they don't show their passports, they can just travel freely around the EU. So there's a strange debate in the UK where a concern about constantly rising levels of immigration. And the UK now has about 2.5 million EU immigrants living in the UK that have come in big waves recently and are affecting access to housing, access to healthcare, are probably holding down wages in some sectors of the British economy. You know, these are real effects. Of course, those immigrants are also net contributors to the UK budget. Partly the reason that UK growth has been faster than the rest of the EU, but there is a real debate that is going on about the fact that the UK, being a much more flexible economy, a more successful one, is attracting so many more EU migrants in. And the dangerous part here is that if you are a believer in the UK remaining in being better, what immigration from the EU has done in recent years is demotivated people on the left, Labour voters, from thinking being in the EU is a good thing. Labour has gone through waves. It used to be anti-EU because it thought it was deregulation and free markets. Then it became pro-EU because it saw it as social protection, environmental protection. Now, just as we come to this referendum, Labour, parts of Labour, are moving away from thinking the EU is a good thing again because they see it as part of that globalisation element that's holding back wages and is potentially going to make it quite difficult for this campaign. It is also, importantly, I think one of David Cameron's weakest points in the referendum. Because David Cameron campaigned in 2010 to bring levels of immigration into the UK down to the tens of thousands. Now, you could say in 2010, it's the kind of promise you make to try and get power. He should have known better that as a member of the EU, he couldn't guarantee that number, because if a lot of folks came from the EU and could find work, you'd be over 10,000 or over 90,000. But he pledged again in 2015 to bring immigration down to the tens of thousands. And last year, the EU brought in 320,000, the UK brought in 320,000 immigrants, three times or more what he'd pledged, of which half, a bit over half, were from the EU. So the credibility of the Prime Minister, the lead campaigner on this really essential issue of immigration, is compromised, I would say. Let me bring you to the fourth issue here. I've got just one more after this. Security. You know, I wasn't expecting, actually, I have to say, that the security argument would be a big one in this referendum campaign, but it has. It's become an issue on two levels. One is post-rise of Daesh, Islamic State, post-terrorist attacks in Paris and Brussels, the idea that somehow the open borders, which those who argue Britain should leave claim the UK has with the rest of the EU, means that we can't control terrorists from getting into the UK. And we need to retake control of our borders to prevent that from happening. But the simple point here is that's not true. It is actually an untruth, as people put it nicely, because as a British citizen, if I turn up at the UK, or if you're any EU citizen, you've got to show your passport. And if I pop up on a system, I will be stopped. Or if you're a French or a Polish citizen, you turn up, you have to show your passport. You will be stopped. The UK, because it's not in Schengen, controls its borders. And most importantly, these days, if you're going to be doing effective intelligence against terrorism, you need to be able to share information, mass data. And the sharing of mass data in democracies has to be done through legal processes. And if you have different legal processes in different countries, you won't share the data fast enough because you'll have to get separate approval each time. So actually the whole notion that the UK is made less secure by being tied into some very specific areas of data sharing and law enforcement is probably actually contrary. It's the reverse of the UK being less secure. But nonetheless, you can imagine this hits a chord when people are worried about immigration, they're worried about the rise of terrorism, they see terrorists who've come from France or Britain or Belgium or wherever, fold themselves into refugees to get back in under separate identities. It's a clever thing to raise, even though, in my opinion, it is an untruth to raise it. The one I expected less on the security side was the idea that the EU contributes to insecurity in Europe. Now, you've just heard the argument from Boris Johnson over the weekend, and it's sort of implicit in it that the EU is making Europe less secure because it's contributing to the rise of populist parties. And he talks about centralizing forces, Charlemagne, Napoleon, Hitler, the EU. And that was his foursome, which he put out to the press on Sunday. And behind that is this idea that the EU is a sort of inept geopolitical actor that's trying to force together Europe in a way that it will never accept and will ultimately explode away from. And that the Ukraine is a good example, that by over-promising to Ukraine, the EU motivated President Putin to annex Crimea, to intervene in eastern Ukraine. And that as the UK is a permanent member of the UN Security Council, it's in NATO, it's got the Five Eyes intelligence relationship, we don't need the EU for security. We've got other ways of having our security. Now again, I haven't got a whole time to rebut this with you here. The simple point I would make, as I was involved in a debate with Liam Fox on this last week, security is full spectrum today. You know, NATO is the insurance policy, it's got the tanks, it's got the nuclear deterrence, it'll stop something big from happening. But NATO is not going to protect you against energy security, cybersecurity, corruption, the kind of stuff that the Russian government does rather well when it wants to undermine European countries. For that, you're going to need the rule of law elements that the EU brings. And in fact, the NATO and the EU are complementary rather than the reverse. The final point, and it's interesting if you get involved in, if you involve yourself in debates with people arguing that Britain should leave, you find that as you go through the list of issues, there's a process of sort of, quite, I think, giving up redoubts. You know, I think in military terms, I'll concede that hill, but I'll retreat to, you know, I'll concede the economy, but I'll come back to immigration. Okay, well, I might concede immigration, but then I'll come back to security. Okay, each time you come back in the end to the question of sovereignty, which is why I wrote the paper that I did a couple of weeks ago, because I felt that had to be addressed. And John Major's written some very good stuff about this as well. If you read his speech he gave to the Oxford Union on Friday the 13th of November, it's a stunning speech, actually. And he's got a lot of skin in this game because he feels he's fighting the same people he fought back in, exactly, what it was, 1993, 4, 5, 6, actually. So, but he makes some very good points on this thing as well. In the end, it is true that if you are a member of the European Union, you do pool sovereignty, some of your sovereign power, on certain areas of policy. And for many people in Britain, the idea that your parliament is not sovereign over everything means that we live in a less democratic country and that you can't throw the bastards out kind of thing. Yeah, and that's what, especially when you have a first-past-the-post system where you vote for your Member of Parliament, and it's the Members of Parliament that then choose, you know the system, the Prime Minister. So there's a sense that Britons have been detached from the mother of all parliaments, the history that we've protected, unlike those continental European countries that have a less deep and consistent period of parliamentary or democratic governance. But as I think anyone would know, absolute sovereignty, A, is a meaningless term in the 21st century, and B, is a worthless concept if it does not deliver prosperity or security to your people. And the job of governments is to work out what sovereign power to keep and what sovereign power either to devolve, pool, or even give up. A British government, after all, are protected by nuclear weapons manufactured in the United States. And, you know, if the US decided, you know what, we decided we won't give you your nuclear weapons, we won't upgrade them, Britain would be defenseless. WTO, International Criminal Court, I mean, there's plenty of places where governments, including the US, not on ICC, have given up sovereign power. The question is, are you giving it up on the right issues? And the UK has pooled that power on things like trade policy, services and product regulation, sort of competition policy, and on immigration. The balance being of successive governments, that brings good trade-offs in terms of being in the EU. But the question, I think, and why it has extra resonance today, is the fear that the EU is changing in a very fundamental way, and that Britain will be less well-placed even to argue its corner in those areas where it has devolved sovereign power. And that's because the EU is starting to centralize around the Eurozone, and the UK is not a member of the Eurozone. So if the Eurozone becomes the source of kind of power and decision-making, is there a risk that Eurozone members will start making decisions amongst themselves that go beyond the Eurozone, where they might caucus on trade policy or on competition policy inside the Eurozone, and then Britain finds that it's a weaker actor, and that pooling of sovereign power leads to a loss of capacity rather than a gain. And I think that's a fair argument to raise. My view would be, as a student of Europe for a long time, even the Eurozone is riven by the same differences in approach as the EU as a whole. The Eurozone is made up of big and small states. The small fear the big try to overrule the small, between protectionist and open market, between creditors and debtors. You know, the Eurozone itself is not going to create a cohesive whole that the UK will be left outside of. And I think there's plenty of space for the UK to be able to influence the future of Europe on trade, on energy, on the single market, even as a non-member of that Eurozone. So look, to conclude here, there's two kind of outcomes, obviously, remain or leave. I think if Britain remains, I see actually quite a better future for the EU. The EU is a complicated, slow-moving beast with lots of flaws. That won't change if Britain remains. But there's a better chance that the EU will be more open, that it will undertake the reforms it needs to undertake, whether in its services markets, whether on trade policy, that it will kind of unlock its post-industrial competitiveness better if the UK is in rather than out. If the UK leaves, I think you will see a desperate effort by Eurozone and other members to try to centralize, and what centralize, to try to force the EU together to prove it's not going to be split by the centrifugal forces that would follow a British departure. And you would end up potentially then with populist parties trying to resist it, a more inward-looking EU, probably a more protectionist EU. And of course, for Britain, that's an EU you then have to negotiate with the terms of your future market access. And as I was saying a minute ago, I think you'd end up with this ironic situation where the UK would be spending more time focused on Europe if it left the EU than it would do if it remained in the EU. So whatever happens, you know, if the UK remains in, it'll always be a detached member. But if the UK leaves, it'll still be stuck to the EU because of regulation, markets, security. And in a way, this referendum is not just about the future of the UK, it's about the future of the EU. And I would argue at a time of rising populism and nationalism around the world, it's about whether the EU remains a force for stability within a more unstable world or not. For those reasons, I'm certainly on record personally as thinking it'd be better off for the UK to remain. And I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Robin, for declaring your sympathy so clearly and injecting rationality and clarity into a debate that is unfortunately riddled with contradictions and untruths, as you also underlined. I'm tempted to ask you, first of all, being international security, about that, but I want to take a slightly different tack. Given that you are here in Australia, after all, and there is a wave in certainly in how Australia has viewed UK's role in Europe from back in the 1970s, when it was seen almost as a stab in the back to the old Commonwealth trading arrangements, now to a position where, at least at the official level, the Council seems to be very much to remain. What is your impression, given that you've been in Australia for a few days now and you've talked to other venues on similar themes? What does it tell you about the Brexit debate? Is Australia a mirror, a clear mirror back on that? Or are there any takeaways that you would go back to London with from your time here?
My sense is that, like many other countries, including the United States and China, to think of two big ones in particular, people are thinking, what are you doing here? Are we really doing this? You know, as I think The Onion said after Trump won the Republican nomination. I've heard a US leader say that this is a self-indulgence by Britain at a time of broader insecurity and uncertainty. And the theme that I pick up from here is that Australians would rather not be thinking too much about the EU. You've got enough problems on your own doorstep, and you're pretty focused on the rise of China, how Southeast Asia is going to cope or not with that, China's slowdown, how that's going to affect the Australian economy. You know, what you want right now is to know that at least Europe is kind of stable and hopefully going to be involved in some big trading agreements that Australia may be able to either ping into or join, or that there could be an opportunity after the Australia-China deal to maybe do something at an EU level, that there are bigger themes out there. And the question I get, and it's a very similar question to what I get when I go to the United States, and I was at the official dinner for Xi Jinping when he was in London last year, where he was talking about Britain being the gateway for China to Europe. And you can see that the consistent theme is, what are you up to? Now, those who are arguing Britain should leave often cite the Commonwealth. We can go back to our Commonwealth trading links. I mean, they say this. And you point out, well, actually, there's not a single Commonwealth leader that has said that they want, you know, you're back in 1960-something, 73, you know, in your argument. And I'd say the same on security. I'd say the same on trading. Those who are arguing leave keep talking about a Britain of 1970s, seem to have detached themselves from the world of 2016, 17, 18. They talk about tariffs when we're in a world of non-tariff barriers. They talk about a world of NATO and tanks when we're in a world of information. And they talk about a world of the Commonwealth when we're talking about the global economy. So what I've heard is Australia wants to focus on its neighborhood. It'd like to know that the UK is an influential voice inside the EU because you feel you've got good connections into it. And the UK being outside the EU means Australia would have to build up additional relationships with additional EU governments at a time when it would rather not be deploying its scarce diplomatic resources to have to do more work than it's already got. So I think they'd like to see, you know, yeah, they're wondering what the hell's going on, which I have some sympathy with.
Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is now open for questions. Could I just ask you to identify yourselves, and if you have a question or a comment, to keep it brief as possible, please.
My name's Carmel Dwyer, and I'm a citizen. I don't have any particular allegiance. What you just said interests me. I've been thinking while you were speaking how much I wonder, is there a generational issue behind all this? It strikes me that the people who are really conducting a lot of this debate are imminent superannuants and not the people who will have to deal with the consequences.
Mm. Yeah. If you look at the polling, it's clear on this front. Those, you know, under, and it kind of spikes up, so with 45 is roughly a flip point between the majority support for Remain versus Leave. And of course, the concern in the context of this referendum, who's going to turn up to vote? And those who are most motivated are the leavers, because this is a chance for them once in two generations or more to escape and to sort of get back to a history of what they believe Britain should be. As one person said on Question Time of our main news programs, or sort of question news programs, I want my Britain back. It may not be available, but never mind, you know, even if you leave. So, but, you know, that call is powerful. It resonates. And the younger take Europe as a given. So they may not turn up to vote because, A, they don't tend to vote as much, as we know, and secondly, they haven't really focused quite, and then they might not register, and there's also the quite specific issues here of how people register to vote this year, which is different from any other previous year. They've modernized it so parents can't register their kids to vote. They have to each register themselves. The timing is interesting. So the latest polling, for example, poll of polls, a big one I saw this morning, had it 46-43 Remain, in favor of Remain. But when they calculated out the likelihood of turning out to vote, it was kind of 45-44 for Leave. So it's, you know, this issue is very important. Now, this is why I find the position of people like Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, Amber Rudd, you know, these are crossover generation. That's why I find their position hard to understand, is what I'll say. And I feel there's some politics being played with the British national interest, which depresses me deeply.
Robin, Steve Meekin from the Department of Defence, thank you very much for your remarks there. You mentioned the sentence, what am I doing here or what are you doing here? That was said, of course, by many commentators on President Obama's utterances on the forthcoming vote in the United Kingdom. And I think you have argued strongly about his right to say what he said, and he, of course, represents the other end of the transatlantic partnership. But I was wondering if you could say a little bit about what the impact of his comments were and whether they'll be lasting, influential.
I think that the impact of his comments, in the end, he and David Cameron are trying to fight over the undecided, which by any measure is 14-15%, which is significant. It may have declined now to 12 or so, but it certainly was when he was over around 14-15%. Those who want to leave will not be convinced by Obama's comments, and candidate Trump's subsequent comments give them a different view. And, you know, one shouldn't discount Donald Trump. Donald Trump has won the primary. He's now doing his, pretty much, I think. I mean, he is now pivoting, you know, going to meet Henry Kissinger, I'm seeing on the news this morning, and, you know, starting to bring himself into a sort of sensible edge. And the Brits, during the initial election in 2008, were the ones who favoured McCain a little bit more than Obama. I think they were pretty much the only European EU member where there was a much stronger support for McCain over Obama. So I think Obama's line will have been quite powerful for some of the undecideds. It will have just motivated even more the leavers. UKIP, the UK Independence Party, is pretty anti-American. It's anti-Europe and anti-American. There is a strong strain of anti-Americanism in Britain. You read the Daily Express, Daily Mail, the sort of semi-tabloid, crossover tabloid to there used to be broadsheets that have become more tabloid. There's always a strong strain of anti-Americanism in there. So when Obama says back of the queue stuff, all you do is confirm those who are suspicious of America in any case. But I think it makes someone like Barack Obama, sorry, makes somebody like Boris Johnson, it takes away one of their resting places. Because ultimately, if Britain were to leave the EU, my view is the UK would become a more junior partner of the US. We'd carry on needing the US as much as we need it now, but they would need us less, and they'd still want, you know, intelligence cooperation and military. We'd do stuff in Afghanistan, Pakistan, but they would have to diversify their special relationships far more actively than they have done already across the European Union. And if Britain votes to remain on the 23rd, then I will say that Barack Obama's line was, you know, maybe worth 2%. If he votes to leave, then, you know, I'm not quite sure what I'll say about Barack Obama's intervention. But I think, well, obviously, it didn't make a difference, is what you'd say. But I think it will have helped a little bit on the undecideds. And it takes away, it forces the leavers down ever narrower tracks of argumentation. So I said, tend to be coming back right now to sovereignty and immigration.
Alex Carradus, interested member of the public. What do you see are the knock-on effects for Europe if they vote to leave?
As I was trying to describe a little bit towards the end of my remarks, I think the knock-on effects would be bad, certainly in the near term. It's very hard to predict over the long term. One of the arguments being made for Britain to leave is, by leavers, is that this would shake up Europe. It makes me nervous when people say we should shake them up, you know. We'll shake up Europe, and that will make them sort of get serious about reform in ways that Britain remaining in almost prevents them from doing. I mean, look, that's a judgment call. It certainly would shake up Europe. Whether it'll shake them up to be more constructive is another matter. I think if you look at where the populist parties are in Europe right now, and you've got populist parties in first or second place in 9 or 10 EU members right now. And by populist parties, I mean, you know, strongly populist, the UKIP or even through to racist immigrant, you know, types of parties, anti-immigrant parties. I think some of them will feel motivated to call for more referenda themselves. Mostly these parties are anywhere between 10% and a maximum of 28%. Under 30%. They don't tend to represent majorities. But what they do is, you know, in politics, is they start to constrain the room for maneuver for the established parties to act as they might want otherwise to do. And I think the likelihood that the rest of the EU would grasp the nettle of structural reform, which is so important in an aging Europe that's facing a big demographic bow wave, that is losing, in some cases, competitiveness to emerging markets, where youth unemployment is at unacceptably high levels because of the way that full-time contracted workers are protected over temporary workers, that young kind of jobs young people tend to get. Until you crack that open, you're unlikely to get a competitive EU that can then integrate refugees, for example, which is another critical thing that Europe's going to have to do in the next 2 to 3 to 5 years, is integrate those people and not have them stuck in ghettos in which they potentially provide opportunities for extremists to exploit. In my judgment, and it is a judgment call, you cannot predict this, but in my judgment, for at least a 3 to 4 year period, it'll be tougher for other EU members to do what they should be doing if the UK is out. But I don't think one can go beyond that. I mean, I think for the Eurozone, for example, with maybe integrate more quickly. It'll probably enlarge more quickly. If Britain remains in, I think the Eurozone won't enlarge. It'll probably stay at the size it is now, because those who've not joined will have a sort of separate group inside the EU but out of the Eurozone they could belong to. If Britain goes, there is no other group, and so the Eurozone becomes more dominant than it is today.
Any questions from this side of the room?
I know that gentleman's been waiting. He had his hand up earlier. I saw him. You don't mind me doing that,
not
do you?
At all.
Okay, Don Beresford, just unaffiliated is probably the best description. I'd like to just ask you to look on the bright side, that Britain remains. Do you see any benefits in this campaign at the moment in any ways that this having a referendum might be beneficial, both to Europe and to the UK?
That's a good question. That's a good question. As I said, this is it's a big gamble. And in my opinion, I'm on the record and I'll say it again, I think the Prime Minister has gambled with the British national interest for a gamble that, in my opinion, didn't need to be taken at the time. But on the bright side, it all depends on whether, if Britain remains, to use your question, it depends whether the Prime Minister gets a mandate or a vote. If it's 52-48, it's a vote to remain. And I think it will leave the UK highly ambivalent, even into the future. And therefore, you know, after the Scottish referendum, there was a lot of hope that the Prime Minister would use that moment to reach out to Scotland after he won a more resounding victory than some people expected. But what David Cameron did the day after the referendum was say, now it's time for an English Parliament for English voters. And it, you know, the Scots were like, hold on a minute, you know, I thought you were just promising us. The first thing he turned to was trying to reunite his own party and kind of re-establish control, and actually with an eye to the general election, because Labour were shafted, you know, and they were shafted by that comment, I might add, as well. Because in a way the Conservatives could ask for that because they have no seats in the north in Scotland, whereas no Labour potential Prime Minister could make the same call. And my fear is that after this referendum, certainly if David Cameron only gets a vote to remain, then his first instinct would be to reunite the Conservative Party. That's what politicians do, is they're concerned about their base and their parties. And in doing that, you may need to say, well, look, we might be in the EU, that doesn't mean we like the EU, doesn't mean this, doesn't mean that, and then you end up not taking advantage of the opportunities that I described that could come with Britain remaining. Now, if you get a stronger vote, anything, you know, above 6-7%, which could be called a mandate, certainly given the Trumpy world we're in, where if you win this, you're going against the head, really. So then I think, and I've heard Philip Hammond, the Foreign Secretary, say this, and others in the Conservative Party saying, we will get stuck in. Because the fact of the matter is British governments have not been stuck into Europe for a good 9-10 years. And if you then Europe starts to happen to you rather than you do it to Europe, if you see what I'm saying. And Britain's got a vision. It's got it'll have to fight for it. A lot of people don't agree with the British outlook. There are various British outlooks, but, the EU only works if you treat it as an extension almost of your domestic politics. And Britons have tended to see Europe as foreign policy. And in foreign policy, it's not even the bit of foreign policy they like. They'd rather be in Washington or Beijing or, New Delhi or whatever. But I think if you're going to be in the EU, you've got to play the EU. And to get the bright side, British politicians on the Conservative Party as well will have to make that decision.
As a Brit in the room, I might just take the liberty to ask a follow-up question, because I think you make a good point that referenda beget referenda. But connecting the two referenda that have been held under this government, what would be the impact on UK unity if there is a vote to leave? Because the scenario of a revived Scottish Nationalist Party has already been raised, but I think there are other scenarios, Northern Ireland too, that have been mentioned. Yes, exactly. So I'd be interested in your comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the... I'm always leery about going here in opening remarks, because I certainly don't want to be accused of project fear, as it's called, by those who are arguing that Britain should leave the EU, that the government's trying to scare everyone into staying. And I think, the Scottish National Party has looked at the history, seen what happened in Quebec, and know that if you lose two referenda pretty close to each other, that can be it. So I think they will be very careful about, if there were a vote to leave, they would be very cautious about jumping. A, they will have 2 or 3 years or 4 years, who knows how long, to wait and see what kind of a deal the UK gets before, and saying that there's justified waiting, to see what kind of a deal the UK gets or is able to strike with the rest of the EU for access to markets, etc., after a vote to leave. And with the energy prices having collapsed after the Scottish referendum, which really made a lot of their economic projections completely bogus, they're going to have a much stronger set of arguments second time round. So I think Scotland would be more likely to vote for independence at some point in the future if Britain votes to leave, because if Britain votes to leave, it will be England that voted to leave in the end. Now, Northern Ireland's an interesting point, because there it's Sinn Féin and the SDLP, if I got it right, the name. In any case, it's the Catholic parties that have tended to be for Remain. And the unionists, who are pretty active, a lot of unionists are leavers, and they think, because then they'll get a stronger border. Irrespective of the impact on the risk of further outbreak of violence, irrespective of the impact it might have on the Northern Irish economy, but there's a kind of visceral issue again that a lot of the unionists sympathise with the harder edges of the Conservative Party. The danger is that will motivate the Catholic community in particular to feel that they really have been cut off even more. And the implications there potentially go into the security field. I don't want to scaremonger on it myself because I don't know enough about Northern Irish politics to comment, but it's an interesting additional wrinkle, as you were right to raise, Ewan.
Thank you, Robin. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid we are now out of time. It just remains me to thank you, Robin. From a great distance away, it does seem rather difficult to track and follow, so we're very grateful that you've been able to import your rationality and your clarity all the way from London, and we hope we've given you a little bit of a respite from the navel-gazing and something that you can take home and contribute to the debate. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Robin Niblett.